You're listening to Sciencing the Shit Out of MS, part of the Classroom Psychology Network. And now, here's your host, Dr. Cora Sargent.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sciencing the Shit Out of MS. I'm your host, Cora. Thank you so very much for joining me. Oh, it's wonderful to see you. Get on in here. Let's talk about some positive psychology together as we sow seeds in the garden of our mental health and together watch them grow. And I think that is something that has become very obvious to me in the time that I have done this, is that mental health isn't something that we can do overnight. It's something that takes time and cultivation. We gradually and gently push the needle with the things that we do today. The seeds that we sow today, you know, create trees under whose shade we will sit in the future. And so when we do it in good faith that, you know, we'll be able to rest under those trees, eat those good apples when the trees have grown. And for sure, we're starting to see some of the fruits of our labor already. And our labors have been many, from acceptance activation all the way to mindfulness and cognitive reappraisal and random acts of kindness. Oh, random acts of kindness have been a total game changer for me. I freaking love it. I mean, I don't know. Listen, I don't know if I am very good at being a human, if I'm completely honest with you. There are lots of things I am very, very good at in this world. Actually, maybe there's a handful of things I'm very, very good at in this world, but most things I'm terrible at, and one of them is kind of human relationships. For sure, I'm really bad at it. And I don't think I really appreciated the value of a good act of kindness in terms of growing wonderful relationships with the people around me, but also like being able to inject something positive into the world. And it's so good. I can't tell you how good I feel after I do one of these things. So for sure, we should absolutely do more of them. And it doesn't need to cost financially. It doesn't need to cost even in terms of too much time, just thought and dedicating yourself to trying to make someone else a little happier in the world. Ah, it's rock and roll. And we just deployed a corker. Now, as we covered in the Random Acts of Kindness episode, I can't really tell you what the act of kindness was because I can't benefit from the act of kindness, right? I've got to, you know, keep it secret. These have to be secret acts of kindness because if I'm doing it overtly to make you guys think I'm a great person, then for sure the actual benefits to me start to dwindle. So no, but I will say, it was a corker. It was so good. And I think it worked really, really well. We went out of our way to make someone else happy. And a friendship group, like some of my closest friends, all came together to just for this one thing, to make this one person happy, completely unexpectedly to them. And I think it worked. And I think we're all a little happier as a consequence. I certainly am. I hope they are too. And I hope, you know, our group of friends is just a little closer as a consequence of what we did. And for sure, we've got another one on the horizon of more acts of kindness coming, I'm telling you. I'm going to be doing something. I don't know what the next one needs to be. We've got some irons in the fire, but fundamentally what I've understood is that it needs to be kind of surprising. That's perfect. Something that surprises somebody is wonderful, unexpected, and that sort of brings people together. If we think about the other elements of this that we found to be really important, like what we're going to cover today is social relationships. So if we do random acts of kindness in a way that pulls people together as communities, then that's kind of double clicking this thing, right? We're hitting two potential avenues for positivity that we can. That's super cool. The other thing that's been quite helpful is mindfulness. Now, I've just finished my mindfulness-based stress reduction course, and I got to say, I really enjoyed it. 4 weeks with a group of wonderful people. You know, when someone in that group says, I have some bladder issues, it's one of the only groups of people they're all like nodding along. I know you're nodding along, yet for sure. Absolutely, yes. Yep, my bladder has become like a puppy, and not only will it not pee on command, but sometimes it'll pee randomly, and it just, I don't know why. Maybe it's too excited, maybe it's nervous, who knows? It'll just happen. And other people in the room are all nodding along because for sure they know what you're talking about. It's a rare thing that there's a group of people in a room that know what you're talking about when you say your bladder is a puppy. For sure. So that has been really helpful. And again, right, it clicks two different things at once, both mindfulness and social connection. Wonderful reason why a mindfulness-based stress reduction intervention might be effective. And last week, we talked about implementation intention interventions, where we're going to try to like plan out how we're going to do the thing that we want to do, whether it be a random act of kindness, whether it be being more grateful, whether it be about kind of deploying character strengths, and then coping, like planning what we'll do when the barriers that we're expecting to get in the way ultimately get in the way. Now, we're generating some themes, okay? We've got some good themes going. One of them is about acceptance, you know, mindfulness, acceptance activation. Lots of this seems to be about making sure that we feel like we can accept the status quo and feel okay with how things are, like, or at least accept things for how they are fully. And then activation towards the things that make us happy, whether it be meaning, whether it be social relationships, activation, doing the things that make us happy in the world, even if, and maybe especially if they also make us a bit anxious. And then the other is biasing cognition, feels like the other kind of theme of all the stuff that we've looked at, where we, you know, the problem with MS is that it pulls our cognition towards thinking about the things that we can't do anymore, or to thinking about like the fears for the future. Of course, it like throws uncertainty at our feet. So it pulls our cognition in those directions. And so we need to do things that will pull our cognition towards something else, whether it be toward the moment, whether it to be towards being grateful in that moment and for the things that we can do, whether it be towards kindness, or whether it be towards all of those things by focusing on the horizon, right? The challenge that I have is like, I feel like I'm a ship rocking up and down on the waves. And every time the ship lurches downward, I feel like we're crashing. And it doesn't mean that we're crashing. It'll plateau, or it'll climb back up maybe a little bit. And I need to sort of stop looking at which direction I'm facing and instead look towards the horizon and focus on that, on where we're heading, right? And make sure that I'm driven towards, you know, meaning and social relationships. And kindness so far has been a great thing towards that, right? As has this podcast, as have you. You know, together as a community, we deploy kindness, and this podcast and doing that together is, you know, a huge part of now what gives my life a bit of meaning. And of course, you know, we do it together as a community. So there's social relationships here too. Please do get, you know, come find me at Classroom Psych on Twitter. Let me know about any kindfulness. I think that we need to sort of create that as a new word, kindfulness interventions, you know, mindful kindness interventions, secret, like super stealthy, roguish acts of kindness that you get out there to inject some positivity in the world. Get in there. But of course, let's not get into toxic positivity either, right? We cover this every time a little bit. Just to remind everyone, it's not all good. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. I got sick at the weekend. God, I don't know how it happened. I got very unwell for 24 hours. I was really, really sick. Some kind of tummy bug thing, maybe foodie. I had a fever and it screwed the MS horribly for 24 hours. I couldn't walk at all without my cane. I was really shaky on my feet. And I couldn't pee for love nor money. My bladder was like a puppy, but I just couldn't do it. I was sat there for like 10 to 15 minutes ago, just waiting, trying to get this thing to empty. This poor puppy was having a bit of a time over that day. So for sure, I had a day that was a proper nightmare this weekend. So y'all who had a difficult weekend, I feel you. I'm right there with you. It was tough, but we keep our eyes on the horizon, right? It was a bit of a dip, and you know, rather than looking down and thinking, oh gods, we're crashing, we look to the horizon, have faith that we're heading in the direction that, you know, we want to be heading in, and try to kind of do the things that make us happy, even in the context of having a puppy for our bladder. Today, I want to focus on social support. We knew that we were going to get there, you know, we knew social support was on the horizon. It's a key thing that we need to talk about, and ugh, I'm terrible at it. This is the one, y'all, that's like, I'm an introvert. I kind of get a bit extroverted when I do go out with friends, but I like my own company. I don't mind. And I like your company, which is sort of similar because, you know, I'm just really talking to all of you. But there's no one in the room with me. I'm on my own. Just me and my mic. But I can live with that. You know, I'm kind of an introvert by nature. I like my own company. I enjoy spending time on my own. And so I'm not very good at social relationships. Kaz, my other half, is like the opposite of that. She is like the social relationship master. She dedicates her time to social relationships. She's, you know, she finds them really important in her life, and she does a really good job of caring for people. And I have always, my entire life, we've been together for like 20 years, 21 years, and I have always admired her for that. And really, it's only because of her that I have connection to the world at all, if I'm completely honest. So I kind of watch her and I try and copy her as much as I can in my relationships. And I feel like as we cover the literature, I'm going to need to, the rule of thumb is going to be more Kaz, I think. So yeah, it's going to be contrary to my nature a little bit, but maybe there's a way that we can do this that's akin to my nature that will allow me to kind of foster better and stronger social connections in the world. We start with Zajic, who, by the way, has the best freaking name I have ever come across in research, right? Zajic, Wuthrich, Rapey, and Walters in 2021. Zajic is a cool freaking name. So Zajic and colleagues in 2021, they wrote this article, Interventions to Improve Social Connections, a systematic review and meta-analysis in this journal, in a journal called Social Psychology and Psychiatric Epidemiology, the International Journal for Research in Social and Genetic Epidemiology and Mental Health Services. Woo! That is a tongue twister. So Zajic and colleagues basically found there are two key components to social relationships. The first is the frequency of social interactions, like how many social interactions you have, how many friends you have, or how many social connections you have. And the second is the perceived quality of social connections, how close you are to your friends, to key friends and people in your life, the quality of those interactions. Now, this is really important. These two components are very separate to one another, and I think they're going to make sense of some contradictions in the literature we're going to find. There's a cool study by Vella Broderick and colleagues in 2022. It's called Longitudinal Relationships Between Social Connection, Agency, and Emotional Well-being, a 13-year study. Now, these guys are some of the first to do a cross-lag study with a huge amount of people around the relationship between social connection and emotional well-being. Now, this is really important because when we look cross-sectionally, i.e. when we take a snapshot of the relationship between two variables, any two variables, let's say like we do a snapshot of the relationship between emotional well-being and social connection, right? And we find that people who have stronger emotional well-being also tend to have stronger emotional connections. Now, if we do that snapshot, we could then start to hazard a guess at the direction of that relationship, right? We might say, well, you know, people who have stronger social connections will, as a consequence, have stronger emotional well-being. The problem is that the only way that you can, like, there's no way in those sort of cross-sectional designs. Cross-sectional is like a snapshot of a relationship, right? Moment in time, correlating two variables, maybe with a bunch of other variables controlled for. That's called a regression analysis when you do that. And essentially, you can't really hazard a guess at the direction of that relationship. There's no way statistically to do that, which means you have to kind of do it in a way that's called like an a priori argument. You essentially make the case through previous literature as to why these two variables would be related in that direction. The challenge is that when a lot of cross-sectional research gets done and they're all leaning on each other to say, oh, well, the argument is that social connection drives emotional well-being, what you might do is accidentally convince yourselves over a long period of time that the weight of the relationship has a fairly strong understanding of that direction of effect. But there is a possibility, in lots of cases, that the direction of the effect might also go in the other direction. And this is a good argument. This is a good example. So Vela Brodrick last year considered the possibility that emotional well-being might impact social connection. Now, the reason is through, or the mechanism through which that could take place, is called broaden and build theory. Now, broaden and build theory essentially says that your emotional well-being or your sort of positive affect, how you feel in the world, increases your psychological resources, generally speaking, and makes you more kind of energetic, might make you, like, give you more resources to problem solve. And therefore, you might sort of engage in greater social connection, like may tend to your relationships more because of the kind of positive affect broadening your resources to dedicate to them. So really fascinating. Vela Brodrick kind of said, maybe this could happen in the other direction. And therefore, what we're going to do is something called a cross-lagged study in order to kind of look at the direction of effect. Cross-lagged studies effectively say, well, let's take these variables at a snapshot at time A, and then let's take another snapshot a long time later, and we'll take a look at whether variables at time A can predict the changes in variables at time B. So we can say, does the social connection at time A predict emotional well-being at time B? And does emotional well-being at time A predict social connection at time B? It's one of the ways in which you can start to actually statistically test the directionality of these relationships. And these guys took a cross-lag study with a massive amount of people, like nearly 23,000 people. And they did this over 13 years. There's a bunch of these very cool studies. We're going to end today with a corker, which is even better than this one. But this one is one of the ones that I just sort of happened across in my literature searching, and it's a corker in and of itself. Now, they took a look at the extent to which people were connected with friends, spent time with people of personal importance, and felt supported by others. They asked people things like, I have no one to lean on in times of trouble. They said, rate on a scale of 1 to 7, I have no agreement or disagreement. I have no one to lean on in times of trouble. I have lots of friends. I often feel very lonely. Those kinds of those kinds of things. And they essentially found that social connection didn't predict emotional well-being at time two. In fact, emotional well-being served better as a predictor than it did as an outcome. So fascinatingly, they sort of took to task the studies that had linked emotional well-being and social connection in a sort of more social connection driving emotional well-being way. This is quite a surprising result already, right? So I don't think I was expecting to find that emotional well-being would be the driver of social connection rather than the other way around. But it seems like that may well be the case here, at least from this study. Now, there are some critiques of this study, which makes it a bit difficult to interpret. They took a look at emotional well-being using a scale called the SF36, but only like a mix of some of the positive and negative items. It's a 9-item scale. It's not very big. And it sort of asked people to report how much time they experienced 4 positive and 5 negative affective emotional states over the past 4 weeks. So they asked things like, did you feel full of life? Or have you felt calm and peaceful? And did you feel worn out? Or have you been a nervous person? So they're sort of very specific. I kind of get it, but it's a very kind of, I guess, emotional well-being. It's a very emotion-centric scale, but it isn't sort of connected to happiness discreetly, right? This isn't about happiness. This is about sort of low negative affect and high positive affect in lots of different emotional domains. When measured in that way, it looks like social connection doesn't drive positive affect and doesn't reduce negative affect in these specific ways, but having high positive affect, low negative affect can drive social connectedness over long periods of time. Fascinating stuff. Now, the authors highlight how their findings sort of runs counter to some other research. They look at Zelensky's work, saying that Zelensky found that sort of high social connectedness did lead to emotional outcomes, but they didn't really look at emotional connectedness. They really looked at extroversion. They did some pretty cool stuff, actually. They basically asked a bunch of students to pretend to be extroverts or pretend to be introverts, and then they sort of measured their extroversion and saw what kind of impacts that had on their emotional well-being. It was actually a really fun study. They basically said to the extroversion participants, they said, okay, we need you to act bold, talkative, energetic, active, assertive, and adventurous. And it kind of worked. Fake it to make it, extroversion style. So that's something we'll keep in the back of our mind. You know, if you're feeling a bit anxious, sometimes just faking extroversion can really help. That's pretty cool. So essentially what we have here then is a sort of confusing set of studies, makes it a bit difficult to know what we should really do next. So we're going to have to go a little bit deeper. Now, Zajic and colleagues, they say, not only though, like while the effects on emotional well-being might be a bit like conflicting, a bit complicated, I think we can actually make sense of this with Waldinger's work. We'll come to that. But Zajic's point here is that maybe you shouldn't worry too much about the emotional consequences, because actually the effects of social connectedness on physical health is actually in and of itself really positive, and cognitive health too. So they were saying that people who are experiencing limited objective social contact, who are feeling a bit isolated, would benefit physically and cognitively from increasing their interaction with others. Now, Zajic's work, Massive Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, their big conclusion, this is absolute corker, I love this. Their huge conclusion, they say, we know that this is positive. How do we get people to feel more connected to other people in the world? Drum roll, please. Increasing access to other people is the most effective strategy. I think that's an absolutely corker of a conclusion. You know, you want better connections with other people? You know, get increased access to them is basically the thing. I think that's great. I actually, you know, while that might seem trite, I actually think it's kind of killer. You know, because it says this isn't complicated, right? If you're looking for increased social connection, fundamentally, like increased like amount of social connection, fundamentally what you need to do is to increase your access to other people, particularly in group contexts. Fascinating stuff. So my friends and I have started a little book club. We meet every month to talk over a book. We're currently reading Norse mythology, which I absolutely hate. But I love the book club because we get the chance to spend time together. I have a D&D group. I have a few D&D groups, and we get the chance to spend time together. Not as frequently as we used to, but still quite frequently, which is awesome. I love spending time with them, and D&D is just, oh, it's a beautiful role-playing playground. And, you know, we get the chance to do Jackbox nights with family and stuff like that. So I think here, the first rule of thumb, the first thing we need to do is to increase access to other people. I need to make sure that I put more of those things in the diary. We need more Jackbox evenings, more chance to spend time together, more things that increase the opportunity to spend time with people. Fantastic. But when it comes to MS, people are going to say, and I'm sure I can hear you calling, because in the back of my mind, my own mind, the crew of my ship is calling to me, but Cora, what about fatigue? And indeed, Lowhouse, Witt, Schirmeyer, Wolf, and Thoma in 2023, they did a study looking at fatigue and its relation to general cognition, social cognition, and social activity in multiple sclerosis and stroke, and conclude, of course, that, yeah, fatigue is a huge barrier to social connection because it prohibits social connection. So when we are increasing our access to other people, we need to do it in such a way that it isn't going to be impeded by fatigue too badly. So digital methods for me, The book club is killer. I can do book club even if I'm super fatigued and I still really enjoy it, right? It's because I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to drive anywhere. Don't have to, you know, dress up. I no shoes even do I have to put on my feet. I can just sit here in my blanket and enjoy the company of other people. So I need to do more of that stuff, but we have to have in mind the potential for fatigue. So this is where we know implementation, intention, interventions time. We need a plan for how we're going to access other people more, and we're going to need to do a coping plan for when fatigue is inevitably going to become a little bit of a barrier. So we can do all that. Now, there's one more study that we need to look at, because I think it will make sense of this kind of relationship between happiness and social connection. And also, I think it is a awesome study. It is one of my all-time favorites. This is Waldinger and Schultz, 2018. They wrote a book called Lessons from the World's Longest Study on Happiness. I encourage you to read it. I have not read it, but I will. I've got it on Audible. I'm going to read it because I only just came across it whilst I was researching for the podcast, and it's amazing. They basically conducted the longest ever study on happiness. And you're being like, wow, what's the longest ever study on happiness? 20 years? No, 80 years. 80 years of study. 724 men. And they're now over 2,000 children. There have been 4 consecutive study directors of this study because it has been going so long. These participants, all of these men, now you might be like, where are the women? Why are they all men? Because they recruited from Harvard College sophomores, and they recruited at a time in the 1930s when women couldn't attend Harvard College. Ugh, it's amazing. That's why they're all men. So the study started when women couldn't attend college, and 724 men enjoyed participating in a study that they would be part of for 80 years. Of those 724 men, most of whom are in their mid-90s now, well, those still living, there's only like 18, 19 of them still alive in their 90s, but most of their kids are now in their mid-60s. And, you know, as this massive study gets to see these kind of huge long-term relationships between kind of all sorts of life factors and happiness. And, you know, one of these men that were part of the original study would later become President John F. Kennedy. That's how freaking awesome this study is, right? These guys went on to like wild different paths in life. And we get to ask questions like, over that time, what makes people happy? Is it money and fame? We know that the research suggests that millennials think so. Generally speaking, I'm a millennial. I want a house. But, you know, more than money and fame. They say, what keep people happy throughout their lives? What helps people to live longer and have a healthier life in that time? It's close relationships. This is the fundamental thing. Waldinger did a TED Talk, which I will link in the description. Get in there, go take a look, because I have watched it and it is rock and roll. It's so good. They say that close relationships are ties that protect people from life's discontents, help to delay mental and physical decline of aging, and are better predictors of long and happy lives than social class, IQ, or even genes. That finding proved true across the board among both the Harvard men and the inner city participants that would later follow. Close relationships are the seed that we need to plant. So it's not just about quantity of relationships, right? In fact, this is nothing to do with quantity of relationships. Waldinger finds that it is the quality that matters. So maybe this kind of explains, right, why we have such a sort of radical disconnection from Vella Brodrick's work, right? Because maybe it's not to do with the extent to which people are connected in, you know, the number of connections, but maybe it, you know, I realized that it was included in Vella Brodrick's work, the sort of closeness of connection. But when we look at discreetly the closeness of relationships, how much we feel like we can rely on the people who we're closest to, that's the most important thing. And what's interesting is that, of course, this is like dissonant, literally dissonant from quantity of relationships, right? Because if you are married, it doesn't matter. We found this before, right, in the post-traumatic growth literature. It doesn't matter if you're married, because it's not whether or not you have people close to you. It doesn't matter if you have children or if you have, you know, parents alive. It doesn't, those things aren't important in, well, I mean, they are important, but those things don't dictate the quality of those relationships. They just dictate that those relationships exist. And it's the quality of those close relationships that matter. So what we need is to cultivate the next plant, the next seed that we're going to sow in the garden of our mental health is those social relationships, family, friends, and community. We need to tend to them, right? We need to tend to them by doing things like reaching out is what they kind of suggest. Reaching out to people, spending time with people, letting people know that you're there. I think this is going to be the key thing, really, right? Maybe this is what we can do. We can just reach out to people, let them know that we're there, like connect with people. And maybe we could deploy our kindness as a means by which we could tend to these relationships, right? Think about what people need and be kind and without any kind of selfish intent, try to make the people who are important to us just a little bit happier in the world. That's what we're going to do. We're going to reach out with kindness and try to, in little ways, tend to the relationships that we find important in our lives. Try and make the people in our lives just a little bit happier. Kindness, my friends, we're going to do it. Kindness is the weapon with which we will strike out and maybe it's the fertilizer that we use to grow the garden of our mental health. So we plant the seed of emotional well-being. We plant the seed of close, important, meaningful relationships, and we fertilize it with kindness. That's what we're going to do. We're going to spread kindness and we're going to watch the things grow. Damn it. I'll leave you as the TED Talk, as this amazing TED Talk, link in the description, by Waldinger did. I'm going to leave you with this beautiful quote from Mark Twain. There isn't time, so brief is life for bickerings, apologies, heartburnings, callings to account. There is only time for loving, and but an instant, so to speak, for that. Thanks very much for joining me. You are very welcome here. This has been Sciencing the Shit Out of MS. We solve one problem, we solve the next problem, and if we solve enough problems, we get to thrive in the context of MS. I look forward to seeing you in the next one.